Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Commonwealth Club. My name is Patrick O'Reilly. I'm the forum chair, and we're really delighted that you came to the For Richer and Poor series of the Commonwealth Club. This is actually the first talk of the whole month series, and it's sponsored by Wells Fargo. And I also want to thank the grocery outlet for donating the wine for the entire Richer and Poor series. I'm really delighted by our today's speaker, and it's my pleasure to welcome him. It's Dr. Greenspan. Dr. Greenspan is professor of psychiatry at the University of Colorado and emeritus professor at University of Connecticut. He's actually the author of a really delightful book that I urge you to buy called Annals of Gullibility, Why We Get Duped and How to Avoid It. Tonight, Dr. Greenspan will tell us about gullibility and how we can so easily be cheated by those who want to steal from us. So please welcome Dr. Greenspan.
Thank you, Patrick, for that introduction and for inviting me to participate in this series. And I want to thank the Commonwealth Club. I'm very honored to be here. I realize there's another event at 6, which some of you may want to go to, so I'll try to finish up my formal remarks by 6, which will leave about 15 minutes for questions. And I understand also that the club has some books that they're selling, Annals of Gullibility, outside. I'll be happy to sign them. I had nothing to do with setting that up. I didn't want anybody to think I was taking advantage of their gullibility. First, I'll say a little bit about myself in the way of autobiography. I'm a little PowerPoint challenged. I haven't done that many PowerPoints, so I'll try not to use hand puppets. I've gone beyond hand puppets. But I do have a lot of words here. It's really too many words probably for a PowerPoint. So just look at the pictures. The words are really for my benefit, so I won't forget what I want to say. So everything in the way of words on there will be covered by me in my comments. A little autobiographical information. The Lone Ranger was my hero when I was growing up in the days of radio. So fighting injustice and protecting the innocent are very important to me. And I love it when someone says, "Who is that masked man in the play?" Is, "Why, don't you know? That's Steve Greenspan." And that actually happened to me once at a conference. A grad student from Asia, where they tend to be more respectful of professors, was looking at my name tag and jumped back about 5 feet when she realized who I was. So that was kind of nice. I'm discovering gullibility rears its ugly head everywhere. So I Googled on the Lone Ranger this morning, and I found out to my great pleasure that it started with a gullibility story. The Lone Ranger was John Reed. His brother, I believe, was David Reed, and they were members of a six-man Texas Rangers posse that was looking for a bad guy named Butch Cavanaugh. Butch is short for Butcher. He was a pretty bad guy. And they were assisted by a scout named Collins, who was actually secretly working for Butch, and lured him into a trap where everyone was killed except for the Lone Ranger, who was nursed back from his injuries by Tonto. And I thought that was kind of interesting. In fact, the reason the Lone Ranger used silver bullets was because he wanted to remind himself that human lives are valuable and bullets shouldn't be used indiscriminately. And he never killed anybody, only wounded them, with the one exception of Butch Cavanaugh. He got even for his brother's death by shooting and killing Butch Cavanaugh. I'm married to Helen Apthorpe, and we have two sons in high school and college. We moved to Connecticut 11 years ago, to Colorado 11 years ago from Connecticut, and you see that big rock behind our house. The Klebold family lives behind that rock. The parents of Dylan Klebold, one of the two shooters, he's the one on the right. It's Dylan Klebold, just before he killed himself. And this is also a gullibility story, I believe, because it's my view and that of a lot of others, that Dylan Klebold, who was not a particularly angry kid, who was a shy kid, was sucked into that scheme by his much more disturbed friend. Eric Harris. My first experience with gullibility came in elementary school when another kid tricked me into uttering an obscenity in a pharmacy. I grew up in the pre-polio vaccine days, so my mother didn't let me play with other kids, afraid I would catch polio. Howard Hughes had the same experience, which is why he grew up to be a little a germphobe and also weird. I may be weird, but I'm not quite as much of a germphobe. But this was my first experience with the fact that other people have a hidden agenda. They pretend to be your friend when, in fact, they're really trying to do you in some way. I first became professionally interested in gullibility about 15 years ago when I became involved in a fairly famous case of false confession and wrongful conviction of a man with a developmental disability named Richard LaPointe. And Robert Persky was the person who informed me about that case. And I became interested in gullibility because LaPointe was someone with a brain injury, had a history of gullibility, and in fact confessed during a 10-hour interrogation where he was told all kinds of lies and threats and promises, which turned out not to be true. And interestingly, that case was profiled on 60 Minutes. Mike Wallace did a piece on it, and I'm very pleased that 60 Minutes is filming us tonight for a piece that Morley Safer is planning on doing on gullibility. More recently, the problem of financial gullibility has come into greater focus for me. I've been interested in gullibility for a long time, but not specifically financial gullibility. But the economic crisis has sort of brought me a new interest in the financial aspects of gullibility. On December 10th, 2008, I held the first copy of my book in my hands. The book is Annals of Gullibility. It deals with people being fooled and tricked and how to protect oneself against that. And unbelievably, it's really the first comprehensive book on the topic of gullibility in the English language. If anyone can point me to another book, I'd be very interested to know of it. So on December 10th, I held the book. On December 12th, I learned that I had lost a fair amount of money in a retirement investment that I had made with, not directly with Mr. Madoff, who I have portrayed as the devil, which he is, but with Roy Tremont, which is the second biggest of the feeder funds, $3 billion. The biggest was Fairfield, which was $7 billion. And Mr. Madoff's name, in fact, never even came up when I was considering this investment with Roy Tremont, which is part of Oppenheimer and MassMutual reputable companies. They talked about their great returns. They didn't talk about the fact that they turned it all over to Madoff. Being an academic, I thought there were some useful lessons to be learned from this experience, so I wrote about it in a lengthy essay. It was a feature essay in the weekend edition of the Wall Street Journal on January 3rd, which was only 3 weeks after the whole Madoff thing became public, and it got a great deal of interest. A lot of people I discovered read the Wall Street Journal, and the headline read, "Intelligent people have long been ruined by frauds. Psychologist Stephen Greenspan, who specializes in gullibility, explores why investors continue to be swindled and how he came to lose part of his savings to Bernard Madoff." Some people found this very funny, understandably. Robert Fulford, who's a columnist for a Canadian paper, wrote, "Alan Greenspan, the former genius who ran U.S. fiscal policy, will go down in history as the man who didn't see it coming, while Stephen Greenspan, on the other hand, will be known as the gullibility expert who forgot to read his own book." Now, most readers found the essay useful. For one thing, they found my explanatory theory provided, and it was really the first scholarly piece or semi-scholarly piece on the Madoff thing from the standpoint of the victims, provided a seemingly valid starting point for making sense out of how so many intelligent people could have been swindled. It also showed that anyone could be gulled, even an expert on gullibility. For example, Sir Isaac Newton, who is obviously one of the world's greatest, if not greatest ever, scientific and mathematical genius, he lost his fortune in the 17th century Ponzi scheme in England known as the South Sea Bubble. And it caused him to write, "I can calculate the motions of heavily bodies, but not the madness of people." There's been very little, as I mentioned, there's been very little scholarly writing about gullibility. On the other hand, there's huge dozens of books have been written about liars and scam artists, such as The Liar's Tale and Harry Frankfurt's book on bullshit, which is about semi-lying. However, if you look in any of these books, you'll find exactly one sentence in each book about the gullible person who believes these things. So the literature has really been about the victimizer and not so much about trying to understand the victim. Recently, I've been interviewed by journalists. I've become something of a expert, branded as an expert on Ponzi schemes. So whenever there's a Ponzi scheme anywhere in the world, South Africa being the latest, I get a phone call. And this one journalist, I think what he meant to say is interest in gullibility a new thing, but it came out as gullibility a new thing. And so my answer was, it started when caveman A persuaded caveman B to go out and gather some firewood so he could make a move on caveman B's cavewoman. So gullibility is part of human nature. In fact, there are even people like evolutionary psychologists or philosophers, biologists like Richard Dawkins who have written that gullibility is sort of programmed into our genes through natural selection because babies who listen to their mothers or when they say don't run in the road are more likely to survive into adulthood. Now, one area where there's been some writing on gullibility is in the area of finance, such as the classic book by Charles Mackey, The Madness of Crowds and Extraordinary Popular Delusions about the South Sea Bubble, which was in England, the French mania, which was the Mississippi mania, and tulip mania, of course, which I believe was 16th century in Holland, where people would hawk their houses to buy a couple of tulip bulbs in their equivalent of a stock mania, that bubble that eventually burst and basically destroyed the Dutch economy for years. Gullibility, even though it hasn't been addressed that much by scholars, has been addressed quite a bit in fiction. Mark Twain, most of his books have something to do with gullibility. Probably the most famous gullibility scene in American literature is the Tom Sawyer sucking kids into not only painting, whitewashing the fence, but paying him to whitewash the fence. And in fact, Twain even opines on all the pain that people will go through to engage in various recreational activities just because other people are doing it. And then, of course, Herman Melville, The Confidence Man, was his last published novel before Billy Budd was posthumous. And it was basically about gullibility. Even of people who say they could never be conned are conned right and left in that book by the devil, actually, in disguise. And, of course, the Bible has many gullibility stories. The most famous are probably Adam and Eve being duped by the serpent into eating the apple, and Samson being duped by Delilah into giving up the secret of his strength, which was his haircut, never having had one. It's been addressed in plays. The most famous is probably Othello. And after Othello strangles Desdemona, based on gossip accusations from Iago, Iago's wife, Emilia, comes in and said, "What have you done?" And he said, "Well, I did this because your husband told me about Cassio, the evidence being a planted handkerchief, Cassio having relations with his wife." And Emilia cries out, "Oh, gull, oh, dolt, as ignorant as dirt, that you would believe anything as foolish as anything my husband, Iago, would say, especially about your faithful wife." I mean, so Othello is often thought of as about jealousy and the craziness that jealousy will cause us to behave. But in this case, jealousy caused him to be incredibly gullible. In children's books and folk tales, there are many, many gullibility stories. Red Riding Hood, I could go on and on. The Emperor's New Clothes is probably the most famous gullibility children's story where people are believed into thinking that the emperor was wearing valuable clothes because everyone else was thinking it. Pinocchio is usually depicted as a story about lying and bad behavior, but it's really about gullibility. In the Disney version, the cricket says, have a conscience, let your conscience be your guide. In fact, in the actual book, conscience is never mentioned. Stupidity is mentioned over and over again. The cricket is actually squashed on the first page. But a bird tells Pinocchio, don't be a schmuck, basically, and listen to every tomfoolery that people tell you. Spielberg did a film called AI, and it was actually a project that Stanley Kubrick initiated and then talked Spielberg into finishing it before he died or after he died. And it's a sci-fi update of Pinocchio. They even have a blue fairy in there. And gullibility led to the undoing of the robot boy David, just as it did for Pinocchio. He's exiled from his human family when he's tricked by his human brother who came out of a coma. So he was a replacement for the brother who had died, was in a coma. And to cutting his mother's hair, they thought he was too dangerous to have around, so they exiled him. There was even a Ponzi scheme in Pinocchio. I don't know if you remember that the cat and the fox, two con men, told Pinocchio that if he planted his gold coins in the Field of Wonders, they would grow many fold overnight. He planted the coins, and of course they weren't there when he came back for them. Now, in my view, gullibility, that is being duped by one or more other people, is a subtype of foolish action, and foolish action can be defined as behavior that fails to recognize a significant risk or danger. There's been a very little or no scholarly work on gullibility. The same is true, surprisingly, on foolishness. There have only been about three or four books on foolishness because IQ is so preeminent in our thinking about intelligence. The assumption is, well, if you're a fool or stupid, which is the more pejorative word for foolish, then you must have low IQ. In fact, that's not necessarily the case. Any of us can behave foolishly. Most of us have at some point in our life. And I defined it into two types, practically foolish action and socially foolish action. A practically foolish act is an act where the consequence of failing to take into account risk is physical, like we all hear about things like smoking in a car with a gasoline can in the back seat and blowing our souls up. These things actually happen. And socially foolish action could involve financial consequences. It could involve social consequences like losing a job interview or going to jail, that sort of thing. And I divide socially foolish action into induced and non-induced. Non-induced would be where there's no other person sucking you and the foolishness kind of comes out of your own impulses, whereas induced foolish action, which is another word for gullible, is where there's somebody deceiving you or luring you or sucking you in. Here's an illustration of the notion that foolishness involves action with foreseeable disastrous consequences. The invisible man is about to be executed by a firing squad, and he foolishly accepts a blindfold so they have a target to shoot at. Didn't understand the consequence of accepting the blindfold, given that he was invisible. John Kennedy Jr. was an inexperienced pilot who had not been fully qualified to fly in night conditions or hazy conditions, and he operated a small plane in very dangerous vision conditions and died along with his wife and sister-in-law. So I would consider that a practically foolish act. He may have recognized the risk, but he certainly didn't give it enough weight. And I'll go into the reasons shortly. Now, non-induced social foolishness is behavior that pays insufficient attention to social danger or risk. But as I said, the impulse comes from the person rather than deception or inducement from others. Examples would be Elliot Spitzer's use of prostitutes, a very risky thing for some, and making wire transfers in the process, a very foolish thing for someone to do who wants to stay in public office. George Bush Sr., or the first George Bush, was seriously damaged in his campaign for re-election. But when asked why he reneged on his "Read My Lips, No New Taxes," he was jogging, and he pointed to his rear end and said, "Read my hips." And that was a Time magazine headline, and he didn't get reelected. Kramer in the shrinkage episode, otherwise known as the ugly baby episode in the Hamptons, he brought in some lobsters for dinner and took them out of a lobster trap, not realizing that was a crime. So that was another example of a non-induced social foolishness. Induced social foolishness is another name for gullibility. Examples would be the Trojans being tricked by the Greeks into bringing the wooden horse inside the gate, and journalists, voters, and policymakers who were tricked into supporting the war in Iraq based on untrue claims about Al-Qaeda and Iraq and weapons of mass destruction. So I have this four-factor theory. My book is basically a collection of stories about gullibility. I do present this scheme in the beginning, but I don't systematically apply it to analyzing each episode. In my next book, Anatomy of Foolishness, I will more systematically apply that scheme. But basically, a gullible act, or a foolish act for that matter, in my view, is the outcome of four factors that interact. And for any given individual, one or two of these may be particularly important. In some cases, all four are important. And I think one reason why there hasn't been much research on gullibility is it's very hard to predict. It's so much situationally determined, and psychologists tend to, and research, social science researchers, like a bit more certainty in terms of being able to predict behavior. But some of it, so much of it depends on the situation and how much of an understanding that individual has of that situation, or the risk aspects of it, which I call cognition, their affective, their feelings about the situation, whether they're excited or afraid or state, would have to do with things like being intoxicated, which obviously affects our judgment and makes us more impulsive, and personality, things like how impulsive you are. And I'll go through these a little bit more. In terms of investor gullibility, I use myself as kind of an illustration, which is what I did in the Wall Street Journal piece, and which a lot of people found compelling. The main situational factor in a Ponzi scheme is what Robert Shiller, Yale economist, terms a feedback loop, which is another word for word of mouth. People talk about all the money they're making. They show their friends and family their returns. When other people are engaged in a certain behavior and they seem to be prospering from it, it seems to make it safer. And Shiller believes that this feedback loop, social feedback loop, lies at the heart of all manias, investment manias, not just Ponzi schemes, but even things like the real estate bubble or the dot-com bubble or the AIG bubble. That is, there are those who believe, along with Shiller, that all investment manias are based on optimism and positive expectations, which they get from others, which causes investments to be valued at far more than they're really worth, or that fail to take into account possible risk. In terms of myself, what sucked me in was an affiliation aspect, and ultimately all Ponzi schemes, or virtually all Ponzi schemes, can be considered affiliation scams. That is, the con artists prey on their own kinds. In the case of Madoff, primarily Jewish people like himself, and he was a prominent Jewish philanthropist. There are Mormon scams even Muslim scams, where the scam artist preys on his own people, basically. Another aspect of situational factor, as I mentioned, I invested in a reputable fund, not directly with Madoff, and this gave it the impression of being safe, because you tend to believe in the safety and validity of reputable funds or companies. Cognition refers to deficits in intellectual processes and the particular content knowledge that you have that make one vulnerable to a fraudulent or flawed sales pitch. I'm not talking about IQ. Obviously, if a genius like Isaac Newton can be scammed, anybody can. And cognition involves far more than IQ. And IQ, one of the big myths we have is the notion that IQ measures all of intelligence. There's a book by Keith Stanovich, a Toronto psychologist, recently on this topic of what IQ misses in terms of intelligence. The cognitive factors that contributed to my own vulnerability, let me get a little water here. I'm relatively unsophisticated and naive about investments. Anybody coming here tonight thinking they're going to learn about investments has come to the wrong place. I devoted 10 pages in my book to financial gullibility. Obviously, I probably should have devoted more. And so, like most investors, I lack the ability to analyze the investment and recognize its inherent risks. And the Madoff scam was particularly sophisticated. All of us have been exposed to things like the Nigeria 419 internet scam involving inheritance. I laughed it off. Most of the people who invested with Madoff for one of the feeder funds did the same or would have done the same. But it was a sophisticated scam, and only a very few people had the smarts to realize it was too good to be true. affect and state has to do with motivational and attentional factors that incline one to make a foolish investment. Affect has to do with excitement or pleasure at the prospect of the investment's benefits. And state is a biological disequilibrium that distracts from one's ability to resist the tempter or his temptation. In the case of Ponzi investments, state isn't as much of a factor because most of us hopefully are not drunk when we invest our life savings. But obviously there are many foolish and gullible situations where state is a factor. That's why they serve wine at art openings to make you a little bit more impulsive. And I suppose the reason they serve wine here is so you'll be nice to me. Now, affective and state factors that made me vulnerable to the Madoff feeder fund. Agreed in a very general sense, entered in. I was excited at the prospect of getting a high return. Maybe it's a little unfair to call it greed because the return was 10-11% a year. It was not so much the amount of the return, and of course many people make a lot more than that, as the fact that it appeared to be stable over a long period of time. And fear of losing ground in a volatile economy. And this seemed like a pretty good, stable investment. In fact, the genius of Madoff, well, there were two things that made him successful. One is playing hard to get. In House of Games, Mamet's movie, Joe Mantegna says to the psychiatrist, they call it a confidence game. Why? Because I give you my confidence. You give me your confidence? No, it's because I give you my confidence. So you play hard to get. Madoff would always turn them down and say, you're not special enough, until they would basically beg him and increase the amount. And the other genius aspect of Madoff was that the returns were small. By making the returns 10-11% a year, it made it seem safe. It made it seem less of a scam. And personality refers to individual tendencies or needs or styles, which we bring to every situation and which incline us to engage in certain behaviors. These could be laziness, impulsivity, excessive trust, or compliance. And the cartoon figure there has a little ADD. So by the time he figures out what he's going to do, he's done it already. And I have a little bit of that. I tend to make decisions quickly, sometimes too quickly. I tend to be pretty trusting, and I have a hard time saying no. Now, foolish behavior is likely to occur when two or more of these factors are present. In my case, all four factors were present, which triggered what you might call a perfect gullibility storm. And one reason why all four factors enter into the Madoff scam, as I mentioned, the returns were low enough to be plausible. Madoff had a good reputation on Wall Street. Even though he never really revealed the details of investment, it seemed credible to people who knew about finance. And most victims, including me, were dealing with reputable funds rather than directly with him. Other Ponzi's have been very implausible, however, to fall for them, you probably have to be even less competent cognitively or more impaired in terms of personality. I recently got a call from a journalist for Bloomberg News who was asking me about a Ponzi in Southern California that particularly targeted Mormons and Christians. And the reason this was highly implausible was because it was based on gold reserves. And the amount of gold reserves that this man these two men supposedly had gathered, if you did 5 seconds of Googling, you would find out, exceeded all the gold reserves in the country and maybe in the world. So to fall for that, obviously, you'd have to be very ignorant of certainly that area of investment. And also because this was a religious group and the ministers bought into it and everybody, reveal my bias a little bit. People who are very religious tend to be a little trusting. Obviously, they're going to go along with what other people in their congregation were doing. A little more plausible scheme than that, but not much more plausible, was the Stanford Financial Group, $8 billion in losses, primarily in Latin America. He operated his Ponzi out of Antigua, where he was paying off the regulators. But he had an established history of business failure over and over again in Texas and Montserrat before he went to Antigua. He was actually left Montserrat with agreeing that he had laundered money for the mob, and he was personally very sleazy. He had children all over. And he had zero credentials in finance. He never gave any investments of his details of his investment strategy other than saying, we have computers. And the annual return, 20% on a CD, which is way too high to be believable. The 419 scam, that's the penal code in Nigeria that covers the inheritance scam. There was an article by Mitchell Zukoff, a journalist, who actually wrote a book about Charles, wonderful book about Charles Ponzi, who preyed primarily on recent Italian immigrants, such as himself. It was a classic affiliation scam in the Boston, New England area, New Jersey. His returns were 50% in 45 days, ridiculously high, based on arbitraging of international postal reply coupons, because the immigrants knew about postal reply coupons, because that's how they would get their relatives in Italy to write them. And it fell down when it was turned out that, or it blew up when it turned out, the journalists found out that there weren't enough postal reply coupons in circulation to possibly account for this kind of return. And there was no real market in postal reply coupons, sort of the way the gold thing fell apart. Anyway, Zukoff wrote an article about a psychotherapist in Massachusetts, also happened to be a very religious Christian, who lost a fortune in the 419 scam. There's no social pressure there because you're corresponding with some unknown person in Nigeria through email. So you have to be extraordinarily naive and probably mentally ill to fall for that. A few other ideas, I'll go through them very quickly. Subprime mortgage derivatives which is at the heart of our current financial problems, could be considered, if not a Ponzi scheme, and certainly based on this same kind of process of peer feedback, the credit default swap, AIG, which is turning out to be pretty corrupt in many ways still. Wonderful book, but Schiller just wrote with George Akerlof called Animal Spirits, talking about how investment crazes and investment decisions are heavily influenced by irrational emotions and herd mentality, contrary to the classic economic explanation of the rational man. And amazingly, gullibility is generally not included in lists of virtues or non-virtues, in this case, non-virtues. And you look on here, you won't see gullibility. You will see folly up here, though. Gullibility is a subtype of folly, as I pointed out. In psychology, the big fad these days is positive psychology. Positive psychology is an attempt to get beyond the traditional emphasis, particularly in clinical psychology, on pathology, on problems, on unhappiness, and various people in the positive psychology movement have emphasized more optimistic things, such as optimism, resilience, happiness. You won't find any mention of skepticism or non-gullibility in any of these bags or lists of virtues, positive virtues, even though you could argue that skepticism and situationally appropriate wariness or non-gullibility is absolutely essential to living a happy and safe life. All of us go through life generally believing others, but in order to survive, we have to be able to recognize those occasions when it's not safe to be trusting. One of my implications of my model of foolishness, including gullibility, is it can also contribute to a theory of wisdom. If wisdom is actually a very elusive construct, it's not easy to define. If foolish action is defined by unawareness of risk, obvious risk, then wise action can be defined as awareness of subtle and hidden risk. Most of us fall somewhere in the middle. That is, we can recognize obvious risk, but we may have trouble. We may not be wise enough to recognize the really subtle and hidden risk. The same four factors that contribute to a foolish act can also contribute to acts that one could consider wise. Obviously, cognition, knowing a little bit about the content area will make you wise. Having a somewhat skeptical personality will help, etc. Not being drunk or affectively excited will help make wise decisions. And obviously, it helps if you're not exposed to a Madoff. You know, because exposed to a Madoff or another con artist, most of us would probably be vulnerable if we had the money to invest. Cognition is not always the most important factor in explaining a foolish act. However, I believe it is the most important factor to behaving wisely. For example, if I had recognized the risks in the Madoff-related investment, I likely would have avoided it. Some wise people were able to see through the Madoff scam. The reason is because they were better equipped than others to cognitively see or appreciate the risk. Harry Markopoulos, however, is an example of the analyst who warned over and over again the SEC about Madoff. And they obviously lack the cognitive skills or the personality inclination to really follow it up. And one of the things I've learned from talking to people who investigate hedge funds is that people at the SEC just did not, they tend to be relatively junior. A lot of them are lawyers. They just didn't lack the background in finance. Plus, they wanted to believe Madoff. A lot of self-deception contributes to gullibility. We don't want to believe none of the Rye Fund people, for example. They probably heard the rumors about Madoff. They didn't want to believe it. It would have been too devastating for them to acknowledge that. In Eastern traditions, wisdom is generally viewed as emotional equanimity in the face of temptation or disappointment, but one can view this equanimity as a result of a cognitive recognition of the dangers to yourself, to your soul, so to speak, of pursuing excessively certain goals such as fame and fortune. Greed underlies all Ponzi victimization, but it's not a purely affective phenomenon independent of cognitive control. It's activated when you believe that more is attainable and when you recognize risk. Makes it easier to attain control over greed. Wisdom is content specific. One obvious way to become wiser is through experience, particularly failure. However, you have to be open to the lessons to be learned from failure. Because some experiences pose severe threats to one's life or well-being, one way to be wise is to draw on the wisdom of others, namely their danger recognition. For example, the Stanford scam was exposed when one of the potential investors asked a friend who was a financial journalist, check it out, and he did, and he blew the whistle on it. Of course, we often don't listen to advice. For example, I was warned not to invest in Madoff, but I was too pig-headed, and I went ahead anyway. Or not Madoff, but in that particular fund. And it's important that young people receive training in risk awareness, financially and otherwise. And as a rule, we don't train them very, very systematically in gullibility prevention. And of course, one of the reasons why teens are so vulnerable is because they have a hard time saying no to their friends. The legal system recognizes, at least indirectly, the gullibility of young people by limiting their ability to independently sign contracts, have their own bank accounts, marry, and make medical or other life-altering situations. This young man says to his teacher, I can't sign the behavior contract unless my attorney approves it. Interestingly, public education in America, North America, we think of it as starting because of to prepare young people for the world of work. It actually started in the Mass Bay colony because there was concern about the gullibility of young people towards the devil. So in the old Deluder Satan Act, they passed a law which mandated teaching of reading in schools in communities in the colony. The idea was that if you could read scripture, it would grant the ability to see through the devil's tricks. I don't think they had any research base for that because obviously it didn't work. In fact, reading scripture can sometimes make you more vulnerable to gullibility. The elderly are a group that's at obvious risk of financial gullibility, and they're attractive targets because they often have significant disposable wealth. However, when considering conservatorships or guardianships, if you look at the literature and how psychologists or psychiatrists or judges make these decisions, they look at whether somebody can balance a checkbook. They won't look at how vulnerable they are to opening their checkbook when someone cons them into doing so. And in fact, that's the real problem. And in fact, this kind of gullibility may in fact be a better indicator of early onset Alzheimer's than memory itself. And we'll know many tragic examples of that where people would sign over their house or whatever before they were actually formally diagnosed. I was recently asked to write an op-ed piece in Canada about a Ponzi scheme in Quebec where Earl Jones, a financial advisor, preyed on elderly people by having these free workshops at nursing homes, et cetera, and also scammed his own church members. They were bilked of at least $50 million, probably more. Terrible case. And I wrote this article for the Ottawa Citizen. It's been in other journals newspapers. And I used the four-factor model to explain the vulnerability of elderly people to con artists such as Jones. The special factors in elder vulnerability is situational. Husbands or spouses are often not around anymore. Children may be far away. Friends may have died off also, so they're more vulnerable to somebody who seems credible and befriends them. They may be starting to lose their analytic abilities, as in a case I know about in Nebraska where a woman sold her house that she had promised to her children, a farm actually, before her disorder was diagnosed. Personality, dependence on others is often a way of compensating for covering up the fact that we're beginning to lose confidence in our understanding or thinking. And also con artists exploit the loneliness of old people. There's also cohort factors often in an older time when these people were growing up. Sometimes in small towns, it was considered rude to question people's motives. Cognitive disabilities, that's actually the area where I have come from and where I have the most, continue to have the most interest and where I first got interested in gullibility. This is a group whose gullibility is often exploited. Now, their assets are usually limited, so when they are scammed financially, and they are, it's usually on a smaller scale. They get an SSI check for a few hundred dollars, and somebody will move in and get them to buy meals for them or cigarettes or that sort of thing. But there are many other forms of gullibility exploitation in which people with cognitive disabilities are vulnerable, such as physical or sexual abuse, coerced false confession. As I mentioned, Richard LaPointe was how I first got interested. Pushed into participating in crimes, often naive offenders. They don't even sometimes know they're actually participating in a crime, or that what may seem like a harmless burglary may turn out to be a murder. And lured into also becoming victims of crimes. It was a tragic case in Pennsylvania where a girl with learning disabilities was suspected by other teens of ratting on a scheme they had, and they conned her into playing a game, putting a rope around her neck, and then strung her up, killed her. And also being tricked into joining cults or gangs. And special factors in their vulnerability. Often they're now living in their own residences, no longer in institutions, even group homes. And so they're more likely to be exposed to these kinds of things. Obviously, they have cognitive limitations, which may impair their ability to spot nonverbal cues or other cues, content cues. As with elderly people in the early stages of Alzheimer's, they adapt to their limitations by adopting an external orientation, where you pass for normal by basically modeling the behavior of others. So some syndromes, such as Williams syndrome, are characterized by extreme and indiscriminate friendliness and empathy. And if you look at young women, for example, with Williams syndrome, they've all, almost without exception, been molested because they're very empathic and they lack the social judgment to see through the motives of molesters. And also affect... peer rejection and friendliness is a common experience for people with cognitive disabilities. They make them especially susceptible to fake attention and seemingly friendly offers. There's an increased understanding now, thanks partly to my writings, that gullibility is a universal and serious problem for people with mental retardation, and it's actually incorporated into the official definition now of mental retardation. It's a three-part definition. The second part is adaptive functioning. And gullibility is now recognized as one of the major aspects of adaptive functioning. Of course, gullibility can occur, and foolish action can occur in people of average or above average intelligence. That's Miss Wasilla, 1984, a very beautiful young Sarah Palin. Obviously, that's one reason why people voted for her. She is very attractive. But many people, Republicans or otherwise, who voted for Sarah Palin are now beginning to realize they were suckered. They were taken in by their own lack of knowledge of her limitations and also by the emotion that was triggered by the buzzwords that she used. And George Lake, I thought he was speaking in this building tonight. It turns out he's speaking at one of the other Commonwealth Club settings. He's the authority on political gullibility. He's written quite a bit, including in his most recent book about Palin, that many of our voting decisions and political inclinations are based on emotionally appealing metaphors that politicians use rather than reality or calculated self-interest. Now, hopefully my writings and the Madoff fiasco have contributed to an increased understanding of the need to be alert to social and financial dangers, particularly ones with potentially catastrophic consequences. This cat, if it survives, will hopefully learn it's not a good idea to challenge an eagle if you're a cat. So, I mean, this illustrates that there are some situations that could kill us, literally or figuratively. Are you gullible? I can find out for a dollar. The answer is it depends. It depends on the specific micro situation. Some situations will pull us in more than others. The affective or state factors that are activated are present. Your cognitive resources and background experience or knowledge for perceiving risk, and the personality processes that move you towards or away from that specific risk. All of us have the potential to make a major mistake. Michael Phelps being caught on camera or cell phone at a bong party seriously affected his career. Now, he was young and had only recently become famous and didn't realize that he had to be a little more alert in public. So is the answer to become a cynic, narrowing one's vision to suspect everyone and always being hypervigilant to spot deception and betrayal? That would make for a grim way to live, I think, and it would close one off from having satisfactory relationships if you distrusted everyone. And most people are trustworthy. Ironically, being a cynic could open you up to being gullible. We think of paranoid people as not being gullible because they're so alert and vigilant, but paranoid people are constantly being sucked in, whether it's by terrorists getting them to become suicide bombers or whatever. Cynics and paranoid people are gullible because they'll fall for anything that activates that particular obsession. A skeptic is willing to believe and trust, but only asks for evidence in cases where a claim may be suspect or where the truth is ambiguous or where mistaken action could be dangerous. So I'm saying don't be a cynic, but just be a healthy skeptic. Trusting others is a generally reasonable, safe, and attractive way to be, but I wouldn't want to be that guy. And Japan is where the most research on gullibility has taken place, interestingly. And it shows that the key to becoming less gullible is not to withdraw from others as a result of being duped, because all of us have been duped or at one time or another, usually on a small scale, but to continue trusting others. Socially intelligent people learn from gooping experiences, become better able to detect danger in the future. I'll certainly know more about hedge fund investments the next time one is offered to me. But less socially intelligent people, they draw the incorrect conclusion that no one is to be trusted, and they miss the chance to interact with others, which is the only way you can become more socially effective and knowledgeable. Now, in Dostoevsky's The Idiot, Prince Myshkin was a kindly, Christ-like man who naively believed everything and everyone. And as a result of his extreme gullibility, he proved unable to function in society anymore. And hopefully I, along with other Madoff victims, will have a happier ending than Prince Myshkin. Thank you, and I'll be happy to answer questions. Any questions? Please.
Better, or you should have known more about hedge funds. This seems to be the factors that you put into account
Well, one of the things you have to sign when you, maybe I shouldn't say this in public, but the federal government requires you to sign a piece of paper if you invest in a hedge fund saying that you have $5 million in assets. And the reason is that hedge funds are inherently risky, and they're not games that people with moderate or assets should play around with. And it's a form of gambling for rich people. And I was told by the broker who signed me up, ignore it. It doesn't mean anything. And in fact, he invested all of his money, $6 million, including his house, which he remortgaged. And that's how much he believed. And one of the reasons I believed him was because he believed so much. And so I went ahead and signed it. Now, that should have been a warning to me that they're trying to tell me something. It's not that I should have known. It's that I should have spent more time on the decision than the 5 minutes that I did. And I shouldn't have. Fortunately, I didn't put everything in. A lot of people did.
You don't even mention a person assessing the risk of an investment. Sometimes you make a very risky investment, and you know that you could lose all the money you invested, but on the other hand, you can afford to lose it. And that's one of the things that people do, and it's a legitimate practice.
Yeah, it's a form of gambling for rich people. I wasn't rich, and therefore I shouldn't have done it. They may be more likely to gamble, at least. Well, I mean, I'm not advocating gambling, but the key to being a successful gambler, or at least not a totally self-destructive gambling, is to limit your exposure and not put yourself in a position where you could go down the drain. And the problem with a lot of the people who invested with Madoff or the feeder funds are all the victims, and many of them elderly, often at the advice of family members who put everything they had in it and totally exposed themselves. I'm not saying it was wrong necessarily to invest in this. I do not claim to be an investment expert. But one should diversify. One should never put yourself totally in. One should always enter into any investment or any other situation asking yourself, what will happen if this thing totally goes away? Will I be able to survive? Yes, sir.
Can I ask you first, from the time you invested with Madoff till it all cracked, how long?
Less than a year.
Oh, right.
So I did the investment in February of 2008, and it crashed in December. And I did very well, I should say, on paper. I mean, I was thrilled with the returns I appeared to be.
Financial advisor, Mike, you need to diversify you and put you in lots of things. You are bombarded with math.
Yes.
You get these booklets, and you get that stuff, and you get the proxy statements, and you get the notices, most of which we know on the Standard Chartered web. As a Madoff investor, you would have received nothing because there were no written investments. Did that pique your curiosity? It didn't pique the curiosity of all the other Madoff.
I believe you're mistaken. I talked in a panel where there were some very financially sophisticated people, and what Madoff would do, and this would be the direct investors, which in my case would be the Rye folks, and the Rye folks claimed they were doing due diligence. What he would do is he would send them reports every month or so, or maybe more frequently, listing all the trades that he supposedly made. These were bogus trades. And so when people like my guy who was a CPA, and a lot of people who were basically salesmen for the Madoff funds were CPA, they look at the numbers, they add up. That's what CPAs do. The numbers added up. Nobody ever really looked at whether the trades actually happened. Now, Madoff had one of the red flags was that Madoff had trading slips. In fact, that's what a lot of the people on the 17th floor were doing. They were doing research. Most of these were high school graduates with no background, and he did that deliberately because they wouldn't have the experience to know what they were doing. Some of them probably did. And they would look up various stock prices at various times, and then they would figure out how to make it come out certain numbers. So everybody got a statement every month or quarter listing all of the trades that were made. They were bogus trades. Now these paper trading slips. Nobody does paper trading slips anymore. Everything is computerized these days. Plus, they weren't time stamped. So that should have been a huge red flag. I received things from Rye Tremont.
Yes.
Actually, I received it from Bank of New York, which is the
but coming through Madoff, right?
Well, it was initiated by Madoff. And Madoff's name never appeared in anything that I got through the feeder fund. I would get these very official-looking statements.
Sir?
I'll get you next, ma'am. My mother was right. I need to say no to my friends. I hate to admit it, but she was. She thought I was always easily influenced by friends. One reason I was easily influenced was I didn't have friends. And so you learn, when that's the case, you learn to become popular by saying yes and trying to be nice. I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm a psychologist in a psychiatry department. Well, I happen to be a cognitive behaviorist. I believe that nothing makes us depressed or angry or upset but what we do or say to ourselves. So I ask, you know, what can I learn from this? How can I help others learn from it? There's no point in beating myself up. And most people, including the family member, close family member, who told me about this investment, who lost more than I did, are pretty resilient. Obviously, there are some people who are completely devastated by it. Ma'am? Yeah, that's one of my chapters in my book. Relationship gullibility is a huge problem, and it can take many forms. One form, I have a friend who moves his family every 2 years to a new part of the country or to a new job because he always finds some kind of fault with the people in the place where he went. They didn't keep their promises or whatever. And never really addresses his own role in this, and his family just goes along with it. And that's because he probably believes it, that it's going to work out this time, that this time it's going to change. And I think this sort of intermittent reinforcement is a big thing, because even somebody who's abusive is not abusive 100% of the time. There are many times when he was probably very nice and seemed to be changing. So we sort of delude ourselves into believing this time the person's going to change. Any other? Sir? Yeah, the South Sea Bubble in England was a huge phenomenon in the 17th century. And it was, now, because one of the things that contributed to those kinds of scams is they didn't really have developed stock markets back then. So there weren't as many investment opportunities. And the South Sea, there was England was in huge debt from various wars. And so this company was formed called the South Sea Corporation, which promised to buy up all the debt of the British Treasury Crown in return for being granted unlimited access to the riches of South America, the gold, silver, et cetera, in South America, and that they were going to be given access to this by the Spanish, by the Spaniards. And so people invested in this, trying to get in on the deal. The problem was England was either at war with Spain or had a very bad relationship with Spain. Spain was hardly likely to grant these rights to England at that time, which in fact they didn't do. They guarded their riches in South and Latin America very jealously. And at the heart of all of these at the heart of all of these manias in the 17th and 18th century, as well as current Ponzi's, is a scheme that doesn't make sense. Like the Mississippi mania in France was equally crazy, and that was based on the notion that there was gold in Louisiana. If any of you ever heard of gold in Louisiana, I'd like to know about it. And so people were actually going down to the docks with their pickaxes. They were going to go to Louisiana to mine the gold. So ultimately, all these manias are based on not only riches that don't exist, but risks that are never really acknowledged. Thank you very much. I'm not pushing the book, but there are some out there. If you want, I'll be happy to sign them.